All right, I'm going to call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Glad to see everyone here. So as usual, we'd like to mute our feeds and we'll use the raise hand function if members want to be recognized. But first, we're going to start with the roll. And Ms. Niedernhofer, please call the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damath. Damath. Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Grinhagen, present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor. Pryor. Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. Okay. So first order of business is to approve the minutes of February 23rd. And I haven't prepped anybody to move them. Is there anybody who has looked at them and would like to? I have looked at them, but anybody else who care to make a motion? Yes, Representative Bonner. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair, I would be happy to move the minutes for February 23rd.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bonner moves approval of the minutes of February 23rd. And is there any discussion to the minutes? And by way of discussion, I would just thank Vice Chair Hewitt for chairing the meeting in my absence for the first part. So this is going to get a little complicated as we get toward deadlines with members needing to be in other committees. But thank you very much for your indulgence, members. So with that, please unmute yourselves. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. So the first bill on the agenda is House File 363. And so Representative Ryer is going to move that House File 363 be re-referred to the Tax Committee. So this is a bill that we will be voting out on its way, hopefully we will, on its way to the Tax Committee. So with that, Representative Ryer, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I so move. And thank you, committee members, also. House File 363 is a bill focused on consumer rights and the appropriate use of government services. This bill limits the use of state resources by private companies, removing the option for collecting medical debt by garnishing individuals' tax returns. The bill has bipartisan support in the House. My thanks to Chair Liebling and Representatives Grünhagen and Munson for co-authoring, and Senator Abler has introduced a similar bill. At present, some private nonprofit hospitals, those that lease their buildings from their county or city, are allowed to submit claims to the State of Minnesota Department of Revenue. The department diverts the person's tax return to that hospital to cover medical debt. Ambulance services are also covered by this program. The Department of Revenue receives $15 per claim, adding up to about $490,000 per year to the general fund. This is on a total collected of an estimated $13.6 million, roughly 3.5%. The program was set up as an expedient way to get money to hospitals when the uninsured rate was much higher. Many more people were using ERs for routine care, and uncompensated care was at a crisis level. It was expanded to ambulance services to address unsustainably low reimbursements. And there are a number of problems with this. First, I don't think the government system should be used to collect non-government debt. This is an inappropriate use of our resources and adds cost and scope to government. Second, in the case of hospitals, those with this option gain a competitive advantage, as other private hospitals need to absorb these costs or hire private collection firms. Third, there are few safeguards and consumer protections. For example, there's no verification by the Department of Revenue. Finally, and most importantly, this program harms the people who can least afford it, the lower income working people. This is a hard place to be in our society. Many work multiple jobs to scrape by and earn just a bit too much to qualify for our public health care programs. Medical debt is high. 2020 survey estimated that 17% of Minnesotans struggle with unpaid medical bills. Too many end up in bankruptcy. Their tax returns are an annual chance to get ahead, pay some bills, or take care of pressing home maintenance. Losing it is a crushing blow and often comes as an unwelcome surprise. How much more in the time of COVID? At the same time, hospitals and ambulances are necessary and do not come to us free. Yet the healthcare system is not set up in a way that truly covers the cost of providing services. As a state, we must take on these structural problems, and I would like to work on this together with our partners in the healthcare system. But in the meantime, we need to get the burden off the backs of the people of our state. To give you a chance to hear more about this, I've invited two testifiers to describe experiences their clients have had. I'd also refer you to the written testimony submitted by the Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid and Lutheran Social Services. Thank you. I'll look forward to your questions and ask for your support.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Ryer. Really appreciate this bill. So we have several testifiers lined up, and the first is Jonathan Marchand. If you would please introduce yourself and tell us who you're from or where you're representing, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you, and the other committee members as well. Thank you for your time today. My name is Jonathan Marchand, and I work for United Community Action Partnership. We are a community action agency located in West Central Minnesota. The office I work out of is located in Willmar in Candiohi County, and we cover a 9-county contiguous area stretching, stretching from McLeod County all the way down to Jackson County. As many of you may know, community action agencies work with individuals and families who are low income and working to move themselves out of poverty and into independence and self-sufficiency. So our programs follow a continuum of levels of need accordingly to consumers. One of the programs that we historically work with consumers is our VITA program, our Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, by which consumers who qualify by income can receive free tax preparation services from our agency, the same that they would at H&R Block or any of the other large box tax services, with the idea being that instead of paying a fee and then paying a rapid return fee, consumers are maximizing their possible refund as well as getting a little financial advocacy and advice in terms of what can we do with this refund? What are our bills? What are some financially sensible things to do with this? So it is in that capacity, as my work in that program, that this issue really came to the forefront for me with a particular consumer who, as we were doing their screening at their intake, one of our questions is, do you have any outstanding debts or collections or garnishments that you know of or expect? And they mentioned that they had their last year's tax return garnished to pay medical debt they had incurred at our local healthcare center. And this was news to me because in my previous training through the four cornerstones of financial literacy, our understanding was that a consumer, if you draft a payment plan for medical debt with the health carrier and you sign to it and abide by it in good faith, then that is what the agreed upon plan is between both parties. The person typically was Minnesota Care eligible. They had a year in which they made just enough income to move out of Minnesota Care eligibility and into private plan eligibility, which meant that a medical incident that they had resulted in the maxing out of their deductible, which for the lowest cost plan was about $6,500 plus some additional out-of-pocket costs that are all on the consumer now. They went to the health carrier or the healthcare provider with what they could reasonably afford as a payment, and they were told, nope, this is not enough. This does not satisfy our minimum payment. It was moved to collections, and then from collections there, the revenue recapture program took their refund. Our consumers are the ones who are just scraping by paycheck to paycheck, and the tax refund is a huge benefit to them in that it covers basic needs, it pays outstanding bills, it even pays ahead on rent or leases for these consumers. So to have this practice essentially yank away a individual's or a family's refund for payment of a medical debt that was incurred simply just to stay alive really kind of cuts at the core of kind of our experience here. And that's it. Thank you for your time.
Well, Mr. Marchand, thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate it. If you could stay in case there are questions, that would be great. So next on the list, we have James McLean from Health Partners. Mr. McLean?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is James McLean. I'm Director of Government Relations for Regions Hospital and Health Partners Care Delivery. Regions is the only level one trauma center and burn center in the East Metro. It's a former county hospital turned public-private partnership that maintains the role of the largest safety net provider in the East Metro, providing approximately $20 million worth of charity care annually. In order to maintain that safety net function, we have to be good stewards of the limited resources we have and do our best to ensure payment for services when a patient has the financial ability to do so. We use revenue recapture as a last resort in the collection process after exhausting options, including financial assistance, offering financial assistance while the patient is in the hospital, multiple checks to determine whether the patient qualifies for our charity care policy, providing every uninsured patient assistance in applying for government programs if eligible, mailing at least four statements to the patients after discharge, and multiple attempts to connect with our financial counselors via the phone that can assist with a payment plan before any collection action is taken. This all happens over a period of months post-discharge. On top of that, there is an appeal process built into the revenue recapture program where the patient can request a hearing up to 45 days after they receive notice that a bill has been submitted for revenue recapture. Regions does not submit any bills for revenue recapture for patients that are at or below 200% of federal poverty guidelines. We offer financial assistance on a sliding scale all the way up to 2,000% of federal poverty guidelines. We appreciate Representative Ryer and other committee members' concern and desire to protect consumers. We believe we have put many safeguards in place to ensure revenue recapture is used appropriately, and we'll continue to work to address those concerns. As a hospital system, we embrace continuous improvement. But losing this option for collection of payment for healthcare services without another mechanism to address uncompensated care will be a major challenge for Regions and other safety net providers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McLean. Buck McAlpin, welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I was trying to remember back the other day when we actually added other ambulance services to this from the governmental ambulances. And today in Minnesota, there's about 300 licensed ambulance services, about 108 of them are governmental. There's only three or four privates, what I would call true private owned ambulances. And the rest are not-for-profit or hospital-based ambulance services. I had a very nice conversation with Representative Ryer Monday, and I appreciate her willingness to work on other opportunities to work on the bad debt side, as this committee has heard numerous times, and this legislature over the years has continued to support the ambulance industry. And Representative Hewitt, the hearing we had a few weeks ago about some of the problems, especially in rural Minnesota. But when we talked about this tool years ago, it was to look for a different way on uncompensated care. And at that time, it was a conversation about an uncompensated care pool for the healthcare industry. Obviously, that pool has to be funded. The ambulance industry averages about 35 cents to 40 cents a dollar collected for ambulance claims. Not many businesses take a 60 cents on the dollar write-off for what they do. And Mr. McLean did a very good job from Health Partners walking through the extensive process. Some folks just don't return calls and don't want to take responsibility for their claims. And the conversation was, is when we looked at all ambulances across the state, and I think you saw a few letters posted by some rural providers, is that little bit of money they collect for revenue or capture decides if they make payroll and keep their ambulance service on the street. So absolutely, we understand frustrations people have about being in the revenue recapture program, but we need to have a bigger conversation about how we replace that tool if we're going to remove it from state law. The ambulance industry is 11 on the pecking order as you look at the all the different governmental entities that collect from it. So it was interesting to hear the number was about $13 million collected on it annually, but I think some of them collect a few thousand dollars a year. That's pretty important. And I even think it's above four notices, the ambulance industry. Talking to some of the billing folks, they say it's five or six or seven notices that are submitted, and we just don't see any response from people. And then on average, it's about $25 a month, I hear. If they can offer to pay that much on their claim, they're not into put into revenue recapture. And the other thing we've always liked about revenue recapture is it doesn't impact your credit, because there's nothing anybody can do to stop anybody from putting people into collections. And the ambulance industry thought hard collections. Back to the point that these are folks in your community. The last thing a local ambulance wants to do, or a local small rural hospital that's utilizing this, is put one of your neighbors in the community into collections. But lots of folks come through our communities every day that are not members, they're traveling from out of state, and if we have their information, they're put into revenue recapture. So I do look at the opportunity, Madam Chair and members, to work with Representative Ryer, and she had some great information we shared on Monday, and I think she could be a great resource to look at what we do about uncompensated care.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. And now we have Mr. Finewalks. Good to see you, Mr. Finewalks. It's been a long time. Please introduce yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dave Finewalks. I reside in the city of St. Paul, Ramsey County, Minnesota. I am an attorney. I have some background in these issues and in healthcare. I was for nearly three decades general counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association, but I want to make it perfectly clear. I am here today speaking on my own behalf and on behalf of a friend and no one else. Having said that, the Revenue Recapture Act, as it exists now, provides an unfair advantage for selected nonprofit corporations in terms of debt collection. I want to tell you about my friend Glenn. I have his permission to tell his story. My friend Glenn is a hardworking guy. He works two jobs. Most weeks he works 7 days a week, sometimes 6 days a week. His two jobs pay between $12 and $14 an hour. Glenn's in debt. Glenn got sick. He texted me and said he wasn't feeling well. I said, call 911. He didn't want to do that. I got my car and went to his house. I could see he was in distress. I took him to a Park Nicollet Urgent Care Center. They said he has to go to the hospital. I said, great, I got my car outside. They said, no, you have to have an ambulance. An ambulance came, took Glenn to the hospital. Emergency surgery was performed, saved his life. They did an excellent job, wonderful care. But Glenn was left with a mountain of debt that he's never going to be able to dig out of, including ambulance bills and other bills. When the pandemic hit, Glenn was particularly stricken. He works. He didn't collect unemployment. He is a retail clerk because of his age and poor physical condition. So he kept his job and he kept working, but he was concerned about paying to have his tax returns done, so I did them. They were very simple. And he was supposed to get a refund from the state of Minnesota. What he got from the state of Minnesota was a letter that says, we've taken your tax return under the Revenue Recapture Act. And he didn't understand what it meant. I explained it to him. He said, how can this be? I said, well, they've amended this law to allow certain hospitals like Health Partners who lease, and last time I looked, it was a 60-year ground lease, a building from a county to act as if they were the government or a political subdivision, which they most certainly are not. They are an $8 billion a year HMO and a collection of hospitals and clinics. Glenn was distraught that his money was gone, and to be perfectly honest, I was too. I believe that this unfair advantage needs to be rectified, both for the benefit of consumers and because the state has no business using taxpayer resources to serve as basically an unpaid or minimally paid $15 a time collection company for private interests. And so this bill is essential in that regard. I think we also need to make clear what this bill doesn't do. This change, if enacted, would not disincentivize people to pay their bills. I know that I've heard that argument made in the past. It's an unusual argument, and it's an unoriginal argument. It's the argument that was used against bankruptcy laws, which allow people to discharge obligations they can never meet. It was an argument first used against debtors' prisons. This bill simply creates a level playing field and eliminates the ability to seize a tax return with minimal notice and very truncated due process. Garnishment, lawsuit, dunning letters, collection calls, collection agencies, all of the things that hospitals use and ambulance services use and every other business in Minnesota uses, for profit or nonprofit, are still available. This won't change any of that. What this will change is the Department of Revenue acting as a minimally paid, process truncated collection agent for private organizations who really in the first place had no business using it as such. And by the way, it would be interesting to examine how much charity care is actually provided in this state. And I would be happy to answer questions later.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Finewalks. So we have a couple of member questions. I'm going to go to members, but before I do that, I just want to note for members that we do have a fiscal note on this bill. Now, this bill is going to go to taxes. This is not in our budget. And I apologize that we just sent this out to you, so if you haven't had a chance, but I just want to flag this for you because the bill actually costs. And it's very interesting to read the fiscal note. Frankly, I'm kind of shocked by what I have read because it explains to you how this program is run. And part of the reason this costs money is because the general fund is getting a cut from these withheld tax returns, which is something that I just found stunning. It's not only that the Department of Revenue is receiving some money for doing the work, the general fund is actually profiting. We as a state are making money off the backs of these people that have been described. So I'm just, anyway, please do read this. With that, I'm going to go to Representative Backer. So I've got Backer, Munson, and Grunhagen. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. This is to the author of the bill. So if my first question is, I understand this correctly. I want to make sure I'm on the right page. So if we have a rural ambulance in any place in Minnesota, greater Minnesota area, and they're a county-ran program or city-ran or non-for-profit, they, under your bill, would not be able to use this to garnish tax returns and property tax refunds to pay for past services. Is that would be removed with your bill right now. Is that correct?
That's accurate. Yeah.
Representative Ryer. Okay.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Yeah. Yes, that's accurate.
Representative Backer.
First of all, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I have volunteered as an EMT for 25 years. I volunteer my time. I do. I put in anywhere from 300 to 400 and sometimes 500 hours on call when I'm back in the district and so forth. We do a fundraiser of $20,000 every year. Our members here, we're a small member. Right now, we're still upside down because we have not been able to collect our payments. So, and there's many rural services. You know, right now, Representative Hoop and I are working on ways to find better funding for rural ambulances, but not to have this as revenue. We get, like was stated earlier, we may get 35 cents on a dollar. So that means the taxpayers of Browns Alley or of a Graceville or Brandon, Minnesota, or other smalls is subsidizing that. Now, I'm a big believer that we need to help people. That's why I volunteer. That's why I get paged at 2 in the morning and handle some very difficult situations because I care about the citizens of our community. But that's going to be a nail in our coffin if we're not. I called my ambulance manager here about an hour ago, and she shared with me the amount that have not been able to collect. And it's substantial for a small service. That's why we have to do a fundraiser and we volunteer our time. So I would like to work with the author to see how we would not be able to put additional harm on our rural ambulances who are struggling right now just to be able to, like one of our testifiers would say, is when the pager goes off, to get the rig out of the garage. We have a lot of people in the metro area that comes out in our area for the lakes. And they want to make sure that if something happens, and of course we don't want to, they want to make sure at Saturday at 2 in the morning or Sunday morning at 9 a.m. or any time during the week that pager goes off and they have a quick response time. So that is my concern about this bill. I will be voting no for that reason. I understand where you're coming. I understand hardships and stuff like that. But I'm sending an invitation to work with you because as it is right now, it would hurt a lot of greater Minnesota ambulances and to get the rigs out of the garage. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Austin.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Ryer for bringing the bill forward. I've read through the bill and given a lot of thought to this, and I'm very supportive of this bill. I don't like growing government. I think government should not be competing against private companies and shouldn't be the bill collector for an industry just because they have high paid lobbyists. I hear from my district a lot of complaints from people that own rental properties who have tenants that are behind in rent and they're losing their properties or they're facing bankruptcy because of this. But the governor, when the big stimulus checks came from the federal government, the governor actually put an executive order out there that prevents people from garnishing those government payments to people for that industry. I just can't believe that the government would be out there collecting bills for private organizations. And especially what concerns me is a lot of people receive medical bills for thousands and thousands of dollars that are incorrect. We just went through this in my family where we had $5,000 because the insurance company didn't think we had insurance or the hospital didn't have our insurance on file. And it's taken months to try to clear that up. And if in the meantime, the government stepped in and took that money from us, trying to, go through this mediation of figuring out the bills and stuff in dispute. I've got great concern with the government just stepping in there and taking the side of a hospital. In addition, I think that especially when government is taking, as Representative Liebling, as Chair Liebling had said, you know, profiting off of this and putting so much money into the general fund, it creates a government that's willing to look the other way when bad things are happening. I think we need to be, you know, independent from these decisions, and we should be focusing on transparency and billing and accuracy of this. And I don't think the government should be involved in this. So I support this bill. It actually reduces FTEs at the Department of Revenue. And I think that's something we should all be agreeing on, is to shrinking government. And this seems fair. So I'm going to be voting yes today. And thank you, Representative Ryer, for bringing this bill forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Well, we don't all agree that shrinking government is a good thing, but I must say that shrinking some parts of government is probably a good thing, as in this bill. So anyway, next we have Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing this forward. The, you know, I happen to agree with everybody's testimony. And unlike most bills, I'm a little conflicted on this one, and because I can see some of the negative consequences, but I certainly think, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. In other words, if we're allowing certain doctors and or hospitals and ambulances to take advantage of the government like this, and again, they pay $15, it sounds like, every time, but we know that's not the cost. We know that the department has to pay people to do all this stuff, and ultimately, all taxpayers are picking up that tab. And then the rest of the hospitals and ambulances that aren't in there, they have to go through the private sector. So it, to me, it should be one way or the other, and not this conflicted where certain people, certain groups get advantages over other ones. So my question is to the author, so this would put everybody on the same level playing field in terms of collections, correct?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. There are still organizations that are allowed to use revenue recapture, but they're public. So it's purely county hospitals, purely public institutions, and then a host of other things, but not related to healthcare. So in terms of the private hospital system and all ambulances, yes.
Okay.
All right, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I like most people know, I've sold health insurance since 1978. And ever since Obamacare has been passed with the skyrocketing premiums and skyrocketing deductibles, I mean, I've seen the effect of this on people's lives and not being able to pay the bills and crying at the table. And, you know, on the other hand, you have a crisis with the ambulances and some of the rural hospitals in terms of collections. So, I mean, it is a... you know, a double-edged sword. And I need, you know, personally, I did sign on to the bill, but personally, I like to do some more research on it. I do appreciate the opponents of it. They bring up good points, and I certainly don't want to incentivize or dislocate rural medical services from being able to collect things, money, when they're already underwater, like Representative Backer said. And so, you know, most bills, I'm either black or white. On this one, I'm gray. And
all right.
So we'll go from there. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. There's nothing in this bill that stops anybody from using a regular collection agency, just to be clear. Representative Auckland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ryer, I might have missed it, but my question is, if a patient hasn't paid their bill, but they have arranged for payments, good faith payments, are they still able to have their tax return garnished or their paycheck garnished?
Representative Ryer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. It is supposed to work that way, that setting up a payment plan should be a fail-safe against that. As one of our testifiers said, That hasn't always happened. And so there are, my problem with it is that it is quite discretionary, and there's a lot of wiggle room for the processes that people set up. And so even though that should be enough, if clients are hearing that's not enough each month, we need more, so we're not going to accept your payment plan, I'm hearing that that's happening.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So I have a couple questions as well, and one of them might be for you, Representative Ryer, and it kind of follows on that question. So are there standards in the law? I think we've heard that different healthcare entities treat people differently here. Are there standards in the law for what they have to, you know, any kind of consumer protections? How does that, maybe I missed this, I'm sorry if I did, but what is there to protect the consumer under the current system?
No, they're not spelled out. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. They're not spelled out in the law. And so that is, I hear Mr. McLean's point about the course that they go through. That's not mandated. And when the claim gets sent to the Department of Revenue, there are no checks to make sure that it's a correct claim, that it's an accurate claim, that it should in fact be collected. It's an autopilot process where that claim just gets processed and goes through, and the money is then sent to the provider. The other thing I want to say about communications like that is I spent a lot of years at Blue Cross, and part of the work I did was around research with consumers about communication. And what organizations send out to people and the ways they send them out and its ability to communicate effectively, there's often a pretty big gap. And you think about the material that you get from a health plan and how hard it can be to understand. I would argue that communication consists of both sending and receiving. And if it can't be received by someone because it's not communicated effectively, that responsibility goes to the sender and the communicator. So I don't think it's a functional system.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. And I have one final question, and this is for whichever one of the testifiers mentioned that this doesn't go against the consumer's credit rating. I'm not sure if that was Mr. McAlpin. So what I would ask you is, does the consumer get a choice about, you know, does the consumer, you know, that is being touted here as a benefit of this thing, but is the consumer asked whether that benefit is meaningful to them or whether they'd prefer to go through the regular system?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that it's asked if you would rather be turned into collections or go into revenue recapture. They usually go into revenue recapture when they don't respond to the claim. So that conversation usually doesn't take place.
Okay, thank you. All right, members, I don't see any other questions, so I think we're ready to vote on the bill. So, Representative Ryer, was there anything you wanted to say? I know you kind of made a closing, but anything, any further final word?
Just two things. Representative Backer, we will talk soon. And just in general, it matters how we do things. We need to do things right. We need to do things in a way that honors our mission as a government and the needs of our Minnesotans. And I don't think that revenue recapture does that. So I ask for your support for my bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Thank you very much for taking this on. So Representative Ryer renews her motion that House File 363 be re-referred to the Tax Committee. And Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
It's hard. Ackland, Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer votes no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Bonner votes aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damath?
Damath, no.
Damath, no. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grünhagen?
Pass.
Grünhagen, pass. Representative Keel?
Keel votes no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson?
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor?
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam?
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer?
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye.
And Representative Grünhagen?
I'll pass.
Pass, okay. 13 to 5. 13 yeses to 5
nays. All right. Thank you, Ms. Mierenhofer. There being 13 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the Tax Committee. Thank you very much. Okay, we're only a couple minutes past where when we hope to be. So the next bill on our agenda today is House File 1000, Representative Schultz. And House File 1000, Representative Schultz is going to move that it be re-referred to the Tax Committee. And Representative Schultz, you have an amendment. Did you want to move that now?
I think I'll explain the bill and then talk about the amendment.
Okay, as you wish. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. House File 1000 is a bill that's been introduced in the past. And for new members, Minnesota's insurance premium tax rate is 2%, but health maintenance organizations are taxed at a lower rate of 1%. And in 2017, Minnesota, prior to 2017, all HMOs operate as not-for-profits in the state. We did not allow for-profit HMOs to operate, but in 2017, HMOs were allowed to become for-profits. This meant that nonprofits were receiving the benefit of a lower tax rate, but for-profits were also receiving this lower tax rate. So what this bill language does is it taxes for-profit HMOs at 2% while retaining the 1% tax rate for not-for-profit HMOs. So if we believe that nonprofit HMOs offer some community benefit and should be taxed at a lower rate, then you should support this bill. Whereas for-profits have a profit motive and may not be providing some level of community benefit and should pay the higher 2% tax rate. So that's what this initial language does in the bill, and I'm happy to answer questions about this language before we talk about the A1 amendment.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? All right, not seeing any. Representative Schultz, why don't you go ahead then and talk about your, do you want to move the A1 amendment first of all?
I think Representative Quam may have his hand up.
Oh, I just saw that, thank you. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I think she has to officially move the bill, and then we can move the amendment.
No, well, she did move the bill, Representative Quam.
I believe Chair Liebling moved the bill.
Oh, I stated that she was moving the bill. So the bill has been moved, and the minutes will reflect that. So did you have a question, or do you just was procedural reminder?
Madam Chair, just wanted to make sure procedures went smooth. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So all right, I will move the A1 amendment.
Okay. The A1 amendment is moved to the amendment.
The amendment introduces a tax on HMOs. Now, this tax was initially implemented as part of the Affordable Care Act, and it was called the health insurance industry fee at the federal level. And in several of the years, there was a moratorium on it actually being implemented. And then in 2019, it was abruptly repealed. So four states, Maryland, Delaware, Colorado, and New Jersey, have replaced this federal insurance fee, industry fee, with their own state-based tax. And they use this revenue to provide subsidies to make health insurance more affordable for low-income families. They use it for reinsurance programs. They use it to expand coverage for certain populations that don't get federal assistance. And so this amendment language replaces this repealed federal industry insurance fee with a state-based tax of 1.65%. And we're following the lead of other states so we can become innovative, so we can fund programs, potentially like the Minnesota Care Public Option, or to continue a state-based reinsurance model. And this, it's been estimated from last year's fiscal note, could potentially bring in $150 million of revenue. And I also want to let members know that we've exhausted lots of money from our Healthcare Access Fund, which funds the Minnesota Care Program and our Medical Assistance Program, to fund reinsurance. And we really need to have more tools in our toolbox to replace those lost dollars so we can make sure people can get affordable health insurance and get the health care they need in our state. So that is what the A1 amendment does. There could be some testifiers and not support of the bill, but with questions. So I'm happy to turn it over for those testifiers.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Yes, I think that Dan Andreessen is here and wanted to testify on the amendment, I believe. Correct, Mr. Andreessen? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for letting me comment quickly. It is just on the A1 amendment. We are currently reviewing this language and that was recently posted and do have some preliminary concerns. And my apologies to Representative Schultz for not being able to discuss this before the hearing. The tax base for this proposed tax appears to be the same as the 1% gross premium tax, which means it could be more than double than what the nonprofit plans currently pay in premium taxes to Minnesota. In addition, this new tax is retroactive to premiums collected in 2020, and it also applies to premiums collected in 2021, none of which have had the opportunity to be accounted for. This would be in addition to what the plans already accrue for and paid in the ACA health insurance tax in 2020. As we read the amendment, it also proposes a payment structure which would also have a significant impact because we would be required to pay 2 years worth of tax in the 12-month period, so June 2021, June 2022. Our commitment as a nonprofit health plans is to our members and our community, including significant community contributions during the pandemic and civil unrest. The retroactive tax doesn't take into account actions nonprofit health plans have taken as a part of our community benefit to help address disparities and meet the needs of the community. Is only looking at the gross premium, which is not an appropriate approach for a retroactive tax. Therefore, we respectfully oppose the amendment, but look forward to continue talking about this as it moves forward. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Andreessen. And Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for whomever can answer it. That $150 million that Representative Schultz referred to, is that kind of projected as the ongoing annual collection for that, or is that the retroactive portion that $150 million accounts for?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. That's an estimate based on a 1.65% tax for 1 year.
Okay, so that's what's going forward.
That's going
okay.
forward.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would request a roll call on this amendment, please.
Okay. Roll call having been requested. Okay.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Okay.
Respond to Mr. Andreessen?
Absolutely, Representative Schultz.
Thank you. So I just want to make a couple more points. Remember, in Minnesota, they're paying this premium tax in lieu of corporate income tax. and it's deductible at the federal level. I also want to note that in the 2020 rates, which were set in 2019, the insurance companies would have baked in this federal health industry fee into their premiums. And also note that with the reduction in utilization, which we'll be talking about in Chair Liebling's bill next, there's probably going to be excess premium revenue that they didn't have to pay out in utilization. So at least for 1 year in this amendment, they would have baked this federal tax, which has been repealed subsequently, into their premium calculation.
All right. Are there further questions on the amendment before we take a vote on that? And okay. Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll on the amendment. Chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Dameth.
No.
Dameth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
No.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Madam Chair, 11 ayes and 8 nays.
All right, there being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there more discussion that members want to have on the bill as amended? Any other questions? Not seeing any, and I'm going to give Representative Schultz the final word here. I just would like to remind everybody that we're just moving the bill to taxes. I'm sure there'll be a lot more discussion. I know that Representative Schultz will work with some folks that have concerns, and we'll see whether this will be part of the tax package or whether it won't. But we can't have it in consideration without moving it to the tax committee. So Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and we will have a fiscal note hopefully in time for the tax committee, and I will definitely work with the health plans on the language and explore options for revenue, especially if they are interested in stabilizing the individual market. So thank you, Chair Liebling and members.
All right. So Ms. Niedernhofer, we are ready to take the roll on the bill. And so Representative Schultz's motion is that House Bill 1000 be re-referred to as amended. Be re-referred to the tax committee. Chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt. Vice Chair Hewitt. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Dameth.
Dameth, no.
Dameth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
No.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. And Vice Chair Hewitt. Madam Chair, there are 10 ayes and 8 nays.
All right. There being 10 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to taxes. Thank you, Representative Schultz. So the last bill on the agenda today is House File 1139, which is my bill. And so I think we'll just, given the virtual format here, I'll just go ahead and describe for members what this does and where it comes from. So, let me first move, there is an author's amendment, the DE 1139, to get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it. So if we can adopt it, it's just really a clarifying amendment with some suggestions from House Research that clear up some things that were ambiguous in the underlying bill. So if you would unmute yourselves, members, all those in favor of the DE, let's see, it's labeled DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, thank you. So we're working off the DE amendment. So members, the original bill came from Senator Abler. And so he's, I think, moving a similar bill, although this version we just adopted just clarifies some language, as I said. So this bill is here for us to consider what happened with the utilization of healthcare services during the pandemic. So what the bill does, it's really a pretty simple bill in its what it's doing. It starts out saying that the Commissioner of Human Services should determine the difference in spending in fee-for-service claims in 2019 and in 2020. Now, if you all recall, in our public programs, about 25% of our enrollees are in the fee-for-service program. About 75% are under managed care, where we pay a capitated amount to a managed care company, which then covers all of the enrollees' benefits. So as you've heard me complain many times, when we do this, the legislature really loses control and we lose transparency to how much we're spending and where the money's going and what we're really buying for it. So what this bill does, it really kind of addresses that issue by saying we know that during the pandemic in 2020, that utilization dropped considerably in our fee-for-service program. And in fact, some of the surplus that we saw in the November forecast came from that drop in utilization in medical assistance. But that's only 25% of our enrollees. The other 75% are in managed care where we pay a capitated amount. So what this bill is doing is it's saying very simply, let's figure out what percent drop it was in the fee-for-service side and then translate that drop over to the managed care side and apply it to our spending there and say to the plans, you need to pay back the excess. We're going to assume that utilization dropped the same way under managed care as it did under fee-for-service, and that you should then pay back the state for the amount that you presumably did not spend on healthcare for enrollees, because we know that we can presume that utilization dropped across the board. So that's what the bill is doing. And so... The essence of this bill really is to really kind of point out how little we understand in the legislature about what's going on in the managed care side, where we've really offloaded the management and the spending. You know, DHS presumably knows how much is being paid for services, how much what the utilization is, and so on. But as long as I've been in the legislature, it's been pretty opaque to me as a member. And I can only assume that it's opaque to other members as well. And yet, as you've heard, we spend billions and billions of dollars. So we don't have an official testifier from DHS, but I think that Julie Marquardt is on our call today. Ms. Marquardt? Yes, there she is. So, Ms. Marquardt, you're kind of the, you've drawn the short straw today to come and explain to the committee why you believe that this bill, and I know it isn't you, but I understand clearly, members, I just want to be really transparent here. DHS has told me quite clearly they don't think this is workable. It would need some work, put it that way. It would need work. But I wanted DHS to explain to us why this sort of simple metric that I've laid out for you doesn't work. What are they doing? How are we accounting for the fact that utilization dropped? Because this isn't just a one-time issue that happened just because of a pandemic. This really relates to how do we know what we're spending? How do we know what we should be spending? How do we know that we're getting what we're paying for? It's kind of all part of this large question. So, Ms. Marquardt, if you would explain to us why this, what I would call this really pretty basic accounting method, does not apply.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Julie Marquardt. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for the Healthcare Administration at DHS. Generally speaking, in a typical year, there is and has been since about 2016 a federal medical loss ratio requirement of 85%. And what that means is, in general, states that Medicaid programs that use managed care, it is expected that 85% of the revenues that are paid to plans are used to provide health services to the members for whom that money was paid. We do have in our contracts, it's not required that states have arrangements where if a plan spends less than that, that they would have to pay back. Our contracts do allow that provision to happen. So generally speaking, in most years, 85% is kind of that minimum. However, as it became clear that the pandemic was going to have these kinds of effects, where we were gonna see dramatic changes in utilization compared to what we had expected for 2020 when the rates were built in 2019, which preceded any of these impacts from the pandemic, as it was clear that elective procedures were stopped for a period of time, stay-at-home orders, we were preserving protective equipment for providers, so elective dental services basically stopped for a period of time, and social distancing and people's comfort level really prevented them probably from getting services in the typical ways they normally would and at the frequencies they normally would. So we did embark when it became clear that we were going to see a vastly different experience than we thought we were going to. We worked with our actuaries, and we did. CMS was working with states to essentially allow states to go back and amend. And typically, we cannot do this. We're not allowed to retroactively amend our contracts. So we were sitting in June and July wanting to amend our contracts back to January. And CMS was taking kind of an unprecedented step in allowing states to do that. And one of the risk mitigation tools were risk corridors. And so we worked with our actuaries to develop and propose to our health plans as an amendment to the 2020 contracts that we would apply risk corridors, which would create, we ended up negotiating a 1.5% around what we refer to as a target margin. So to try to make that, I'm going to try to make it as simple in the language I usually have to say to make it understandable to myself. Essentially, if we think that when we built the rates, on average across the contracts, if we assume that the expected target margin or what the amount we expected plans to spend, meaning an average plan with average efficiency, should have spent about 90% of the money we paid on health services. So the original rates were built kind of with that general assumption. The percentages are more fine-tuned than that, and they vary across our products. But for the illustration, we'll just use 90%. And so what we amended our contracts to say was that if they were 1.5% below that, meaning they spent 88.5%, well, less than 88.5%, any profit they made because up to that amount, they have to return back to the state. So if they spent 70%, that extra 18.5% is coming back to the state. If, on the other hand, what we also didn't know was how many people were going to get it, how expensive was care going to be, what was really going to happen. So there, it also protects the plans on the other side that if for some reason, which is probably not the case for 2020, things would have cost far more than we expected, then anything over 91.5%. So if they spent more than 91.5% of the revenue on healthcare costs, the state would pick up the cost for help for the health services over and above that. So those are, that's the corridor then, is that 1.5 above or below that target margin. And so, or that target MLR. We did that in 2020. We have also incorporated a similar mechanism for our 2021 contracts. Also not knowing how long into 2021, not knowing if we'll see pent up demand come back. So the advice of our actuaries really was to treat the 2 years as a 2 year time period. So because we already have those mechanisms in place, those are submitted to CMS. If we were to try to apply a new metric on top of that risk corridor, we would really be altering the risk corridors that we've negotiated and submitted outside of the contract. And so we'd have to resubmit the contract. And it's not, in the unusual circumstance we were allowed to retroactively amend our contract, it's generally not allowed to do that. So 2020 is a closed year. For us to go back and say we're going to go amend our 2020 contract back to January 1st of 2020 would be kind of unprecedented over unprecedented. It would be highly unusual for CMS to allow us to do that. So I think there's just a concern about, can we even open up those contracts to do this? But then moreover, there's a concern that we would have to examine, okay, a fee-for-service population and applying an experience in a different population to a managed care population and say that those two things are somehow equivalent, and whether or not actuaries would agree that that's an actuarially sound rate or an actuarially sound risk mitigation strategy. So I hope that's helpful, or if you have any questions, I'm happy to.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ms. Marquardt. Don't go anyplace. I see we have a couple of hands up. We also have Mr. Andreessen would like to testify as well. And did members want to ask questions first, or should we? Okay, let's let Mr. Andreessen speak, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Andreessen, welcome again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1139. We met with Chair Liebling this morning and appreciated that conversation. However, we are here to testify in opposition to the bill. As Ms. Marquardt stated, there are several mechanisms already in place to ensure that managed care organizations are not overpaid for the work that they perform for the managed care program. And we know that there's been, you know, several questions about lower healthcare utilization, how that impacts what the state is paying. But this is why our contracts have these built-in mechanisms, which are mandated by federal and state government to prevent plans from collecting excess margins. So I won't go get into what Ms. Marquardt had mentioned. She did a good job of, you know, explaining MLR and the risk corridors. And as you've mentioned, Madam Chair, you know, the November forecast showed an anticipated remittance from MCOs to the state. And we assume this will be in the February forecast as well. The contracts that are signed between the MCOs and DHS are done so in good faith and with agreed upon terms, knowing that there's going to be wild fluctuations in the healthcare market. Now, we're concerned with the approach to retroactively reopen these contracts and change the agreed upon terms for a year that, for most of all plans, have already closed their financial books in the past few weeks. So with that, the council respectfully opposes House File 1139, but is open to continuing discussion on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Please don't go any place in case we have questions for you. Representative Schultz and then Quam.
Chair Liebling, I have a question for Ms. Marquardt. So if the managed care organizations only spent 70% of the capitated amount on medical care, does that mean a greater percentage would be refunded to the state, or are your risk corridors very narrow?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, yes. So if the percentage spent is less than 88.5 in my example, anything below that they didn't spend is coming back up to that level. So, right, if it was 80%, that difference of that 8.5, if it was 70, it's 18.5% is coming back. So it is whatever would otherwise be profit because they didn't spend it, that would be returned with after they meet that 1.5% threshold.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And is that going back to the general fund, that refund?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, it is the money that we return for our Medicaid products of course the Minnesota Care would go back to the trust.
Okay.
Right. Representative Schultz, anything further?
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, and Madam Chair, I should also, we will have to give, the federal share will go back to the federal government too.
Yeah, it's very important to mention that. We don't want anybody listening to think we're trying to pull a fast one on that. No way. Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So do we then audit their claims to determine their medical spend?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, we get encounter claims. So yes, we have records of the claims they paid. Along with this provision, we did include some language that allows more and probably a little bit deeper examination of payments, that if we were to see changes in rates or changes in payments, maybe particularly to entities that might be related to the health plan, that we may want to look at those and figure out why those were necessary or why just them and not other similarly situated providers. There may have been valid reasons that they raised rates. They do have the flexibility to do that if they were trying to maintain access. Those things are okay, but we are allowing, and we were able to negotiate some ability for the state to look a little bit deeper and ask more questions if we do see something that just raises a question for us.
One more question, Chair Liebling.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So who conducts these audits? Do we have a vendor for that, or is that internal audited?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, so I wouldn't characterize it as an audit. So that's, I want to be clear, we're not auditing. What we are doing is we tie out the claims experience. So our actuaries look at it, and we look at it in consultation with our actuaries. So our internal staff do that along with our contract actuaries.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Marquardt. Representative Quam and then Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad that the comment, and that we're letting people know that part of the money that comes back needs to go to the feds. We had some issues a few years ago, and I wanted to make sure if we did any additional adjustments, like, you know, in the bill, that we would continue to keep in account that some of the money would have to go to the feds. My two concerns are, this year, a lot of procedures, screenings, and some cancer-related procedures were delayed. And my fear is that their costs were pushed off into next year. And I know that we've adjusted what is allowed in the past for reserves. And if there's some concern that maybe there was excess money left over in 2020, that discussions with the healthcare entities about having a larger carryover reserve might be one way of sort of helping with this situation and preventing a future issue for us to talk about next year. And those are the two things I wanted to touch upon, and I don't know if anyone from the DHS wanted to comment on those. I just wanted to make sure it was spoken about, so we're thinking about it as we move forward. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. Ms. Marquardt, did you want to comment at all? You don't have to.
Madam Chair, the only thing I would clarify is that I think exactly what Representative Quam is talking about is why we also incorporated these for the 2021 contracts, because if we did see pent-up demand or more services occur in 2020 that were delayed from 2021, plans have protection from those increased costs, where the state will come in and reimburse those increased healthcare costs that exceed that target plus the risk corridor.
Okay, Representative Pryor.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the discussion and clarification that we're hearing today. I have two questions. The first question is, I wasn't altogether clear when we were talking about these risk corridors. Is that something that was just for this 20? Is it just for the 2021 years, or is this something that was done before and is going to be ongoing afterwards?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so they have been used in the past, not frequently. It's not an annual thing. Generally speaking, we do not have risk corridors in our contracts at all. We use them. I believe the last time they were used, perhaps, if I'm correct, because it predates me, but I believe we may have used them when we brought up special needs basic care. So with a new population and you're not quite sure what the experience is going to look like, these are risk mitigation tools that may be appropriate to use until you kind of get a sense of the predictable costs for the population. This was a circumstance where things were getting very unpredictable. And so this tool became something that made sense to use for these 2 years, and we'll kind of have to see how things progress, but I think in a general typical time period, we would not be using risk corridors.
Representative Pryor, follow up?
Yep, thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. And then Ms. Marquardt, my second question is, you described, hypothetical scenarios of if it's the 1.5%, around the 90% as hypothetical, and I understand that that's just something that we're throwing out. But let's say it was, just 80% or 70%. Would there actually be some kind of transparency that this committee would know that, in 2020, this is how far below utilization was, and that we're actually, it exceeded the risk corridor, and that there would be money returned to the general fund? Or would we wait till after 2021, after, this whole process is over? Or is that anything that this committee would be able to see the data on to compare it with the fee-for-service plan?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so I we definitely will provide information as to what was calculated for each health plan, how much was taken back, that we actually and absolutely can share and would intend to. We expect to do our first interim calculation in the spring and summer of 2021, which will be the interim for 2020. We have to wait until all the claims experience, until all the claims they have paid have really run out and are complete to do our final. So we are doing a preliminary one yet this fiscal year, and then we'll do a final settle up 1 year later for 2020. And then the 2021 interim and final will be a year after that. But we can absolutely share. I will say it's based primarily on the financial data that the plans submit. And I think if people are looking for, well, how much less did you spend on this, this, or this, you're probably not going to get that level of detail. So just to manage some expectations, it will be more of a global for all services. This is how much was paid versus what we may have expected in the target.
Thank you. And so before I go to Representative Grinhagen, so Ms. Marquardt, I'm so glad that Representative Pryor asked that question, because that's kind of my question too. And just to continue with that a little bit, why can't we know what didn't happen that used to happen? Why can't we know why there's less spending? And is there some kind of comparison then that, as in this bill, House Bill 1139 attempts to say, let's look at fee-for-service spending, and let's look at capitated spending and what the drop is in each. And is there going to be some kind of comparison between those two? So kind of two questions there. Like, why the heck do we not get to know, as what Representative Pryor was asking?
Madam Chair, it's not that you can't know. I mean, at the aggregate level, you absolutely can. The MLR, the way that it's calculated, is just an aggregate amount. So if there are, we do get some really high-level categorical information. And I know when the forecast is looked at with respect to fee-for-service, they kind of look at some categories of spend. So it wouldn't be impossible for us to try to do a similar comparison. That isn't how the MLR is necessarily calculated, but it would be an additional data report that we could create or could produce, at least at trying to do some kind of an apples to apples.
Right. So Ms. Marquardt, I understand you. This isn't something you automatically that DHS generates and puts together a report, but this is information I assume that DHS gets, and that if someone wanted to have it, it would in fact be available.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, great. Good to know that. Okay, Representative Grinhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, we've been talking about this a long time.
Too long,
yeah. But my question is for Ms. Marquardt. Couldn't you just, rather than the back and forth on what has been spent, just make an estimate of the upcoming biennium reduction and bring them to the table and have that discussion instead of doing a back and forth on the money? Just give them a reduction in the upcoming biennium based upon your figures and bring them to the table, and hopefully they will present the information. Why or why not? It's just a different approach. It's just a suggestion. I don't know what your thoughts are. Okay.
Maybe we should ask Mr. Andreessen. I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but maybe give him an opportunity to weigh in on that one, because his folks would be on the receiving end of that approach. Mr. Andreessen, do you want to respond? You don't have to if you don't want to.
Sure, Madam Chair. I think the general idea is that, our folks, bid on these contracts based on kind of their expectation of what, that cost will be for serving that population for the year. And then, the MLR kicks in when things, happen, such as a pandemic or something else that makes adjustments at the end of the year. So that's kind of the process we see from our standpoint. So not that answers your question, Representative Grunhagen, but
thank you. Representative Grunhagen, follow up.
Put out there for food for thought, just to for people to think about on the different types of approaches. And obviously, I think most of us want the same thing. It's just how do you get there in terms of the accountability and the protection of taxpayers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. So, okay, well, and seeing no other questions, I just would finally, before I lay the bill over, I would just say, first of all, thank you to Ms. Marquardt for being willing to come and be on the hot seat, and to Mr. Andreessen as well. We appreciate that. And, you know, I think that the discussion here really illustrates kind of, the discussion is kind of the point here about what a really complicated system. And every one of us on this committee, members, as a member of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, your constituents think that you are in control of the money that we are spending here. And think about that. You know, so there will be a quiz on what Ms. Marquardt told us. No, just kidding. Of course there won't, because, you know, I couldn't tell you, I couldn't actually repeat it back to you myself, and I've been doing this for a long time. So that's how... just really, it does illustrate how complicated this is, and just some food for thought. So, all right. So with that, House File 1139 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And we have for our next meeting, I just want to remind members, is Friday. We don't usually meet on Fridays, but we're going to be meeting Fridays for a while to try to get through our work. So we're meeting Friday at 3 o'clock, and we're taking up a number of bills. And what we're going to do is try to push through as many as we can. And whatever we don't, we'll have to hold over till the next meeting. But we're trying to schedule such that we can get through everything and get as much work done as we can, even in this really slow, awkward environment. So thank you all for your patience and your cooperation. And with that, we are adjourned.